Morning, Council. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Wednesday, July 10th, 2024. We have four cases on our oral calendar today. This is the second of them. This is A24-0054 in the matter of the peace officer license of Thomas Andrew Winsell, license number 18612. Counsel for appellant, you will have 15 minutes, followed by 15 minutes by respondent, and then 5 minutes for rebuttal by appellant, if you so choose. The podium in the middle, you can lower and there's a button underneath to lower and raise it, and you can also modify the microphone as well, so we can hear you properly. This is being recorded and being live streamed. However, no other recording is permitted. When you begin your arguments, please state your name for the record and the party you are representing. And with that, counsel, you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Mark Schneider, and I represent licensee Peace Officer Thomas Winsell in the matter now before the court. Officer Winsell dedicated 23 years of his life to his chosen profession and calling as a licensed peace officer. That all came to an end on December 11th of 2023 when the Post Board issued its order revoking his peace officer's license. The Post Board's interpretation of Minnesota Statute 609.066 was flawed. Its application to the facts in this matter was in error. The Board's decision was not supported by the evidence upon review of the record in its entirety and was arbitrary and capricious. Revocation of Officer Winsell's peace officer's license was unsupported by the evidence, arbitrary, and punitive. It was the result of the Board's will rather than its judgment. Respondent asserts in its reply brief to Officer Winsell's principal brief that revocation is a necessary tool for regulators to protect the public from three things: one, incompetency; two, dishonesty; and three, unqualified licensees. There is no evidence in this record of dishonesty on the part of Officer Winsell. In fact, the record is clear that he was honest, contrite, and forthcoming, not only with the internal affairs investigation at the St. Peter Police Department, but he was open and forthright with the Complaint Investigation Committee. He testified truthfully and consistently at the contested case hearing in front of the administrative law judge, and he maintained his position all along. Further, the record is devoid of evidence that he's not qualified as a licensee. He gave 23 years as a licensed peace officer without any prior discipline, either at the agency level or at the state level through the Post Board. That's important. Really, what this is boiling down to is whether he's incompetent as a licensed peace officer. And I respectfully submit to this court, he is not incompetent. The evidence does not support his incompetency.
What do you mean, counsel, it boils down to competency? I didn't understand that that was the basis for the discipline that was here posed.
What I'm arguing, Your Honor, is that in the respondent's brief, the Post Board's brief, they talk about the bases or the reason for revocation. And it's those three bases of incompetency, dishonesty, and not being qualified as a licensee. This part of the argument is going to the nature of the discipline.
But isn't the bottom line here that the issue, it was the unauthorized use of force in this particular case, and that's the basis for the discipline, which in this case was revocation?
Correct. And that was my next point. I mean, the sole issue before the administrative law judge and before the Post Board was whether or not Officer Winsell violated Rule 6700.1600, subparagraph O, whether the use of deadly force was unauthorized under Minnesota Statute 609.066. The Board's application of that law to the facts of this case was error. Its findings are not supported in the record upon review of the entirety of the record, and it was arbitrary and capricious. Now, I understand deference is owed to an administrative agency. I understand that the Post Board and other agencies in the state of Minnesota are deemed to have special expertise, training, qualifications, knowledge. That's why there are various licensing boards. But the deference owed to those agencies is not unfettered. There has to be a basis in the record for their actions, their decision, and ultimately the discipline they mete out to a particular licensee.
So, counsel, it looks like there are really two issues here, whether or not the there is error in terms of the decision that he engaged in unauthorized deadly force, and then the revocation of his license, and whether that was arbitrary and capricious. And with respect to the standard of review, as long as there's evidence to support the agency's decision, even if we might have come to a different conclusion, we still give deference to the agency, very similar to what we do with district courts. Even if we might have come to a different conclusion from a district court, as long as the record supports it, as long as there's evidence, then we defer to that decision, even if we would have reached a different decision. So my question to you is here, isn't it really an issue of the record and the agency's finding certain testimony, expert testimony, credible, and other testimony not credible?
There certainly was a credibility determination by the administrative law judge and ultimately the Post Board, and I'm not asking this court to substitute its judgment for that of the agency. But beyond the credibility determinations, for instance, the state will or may argue that the board and the administrative law judge felt that Mr. Albert's expert testimony and evidence was credible as compared to Commander Weinbeck's, who is a licensed peace officer in the state of Minnesota, boots on the ground experience. I'm not asking you to weigh that credibility, but let's look at what Albert actually said. Albert talked about a couple of things. Number one is increasing the risk that pursuit either never should have happened, which is what he put in his report. It never should have been initiated. And as the threat heightened, it should have been terminated. He also testified that had the pursuit been terminated, it would have ended. Mr. Gutman would have stopped fleeing. He would have went into the correct lane of traffic. We don't know that. And I think the Scott v. Harris case that we've talked about in our brief is very enlightening in this instance. Scott v. Harris is a U.S. Supreme Court case that is applying the principles, Tennessee v. Gardner, Graham v. Connor, et cetera, which the state of Minnesota has essentially codified or follows as part of its analysis under 609.066. But Mr. Albert was the expert in that case. He had the same opinion about had the officer terminated the pursuit, there would have been no crash, no harm, no use of force. And the Supreme Court unilaterally disregarded that. Nobody knows what would have happened. What we do know in this case is that the conduct of Mr. Gutman increased the threat of harm to the general public, to the motoring public who were riding and driving their vehicles on southbound 169 that night near St. Peter, Minnesota.
So why didn't the officer's conduct of chasing that car going north in a southbound lane of 169, why didn't the officer's conduct, as was found by the board, also increase the risk to the public?
The board found that there were two vehicles, and Officer Wenzel's actions were in response to Mr. Gutman's actions, as they are in any pursuit. Many of the cases we cited in our brief talk about the threat posed by the bad guy, the threat posed by the fleeing individual, and the officer's response to that. And again, our job and the board's job and the ALJ's job was not to Monday morning quarterback. It was not to look at hindsight and say what would have been better, what would have been different. There's a range of reasonableness when an officer makes a split second on the scene decision about what to do when they're facing a threat to the public, an increasing threat to the public, and how to act appropriate.
Right, but that's an argument more for official immunity from the sounds of it. And speaking for myself, I agree with you in terms of nobody knows what the person that the officer was chasing, what they would have done, whether or not they would have continued to engage, you know, drive carelessly, recklessly at over 130 miles an hour or into oncoming traffic. What we do know is the responsibility of the officer based on the various testimony. I also want to ask you about the internal policy, because the internal policy says that an officer should not engage in a high-speed chase or drive into oncoming traffic without prior authorization from a supervisor. And there seems to be an indication in the record that the officer could have sought that permission from the superior prior to doing that, or if you can't contact the officer, not even engage in that, as well as the ramming of the vehicle that occurred at the end of the chase. So why don't those support the agency's decision as well, the board's decision?
Well, I think the policies play a role, but I would respectfully submit not a significant role.
Why not?
Conclusion of law number 10, found by the board, and that's it. Relator's addendum, pages 20 to 21, talks about the contours of Minnesota statute 609.066 are determined or guided by policy and training. We have the Wren decision that indicates that policy cannot usurp the constitutional review of an officer's use of force when determining whether or not that force was reasonable, authorized, or justified. Plus, we have, Judge Reyes, a lot of testimony in the record, not only from Mr. Alpert, but from Chief Grokow, the St. Peter Police Department chief, about the inadequacies and insufficiencies of the St. Peter policies. There was no supervisor on duty that night. Could Officer Wenzel have picked up his phone while in a pursuit to call his chief, who was not on duty, although I know chiefs are always on duty, and made that phone call while concentrating on a pursuit on Highway 169? Again, we're talking about 4 minutes and approximately 30 seconds from the start of the pursuit at the campground until the ram and the termination of the pursuit. We're talking about less than 1 minute when Mr. Goodham was going to turn left into the hills and decided to go straight into southbound lane of traffic. There was no opportunity or time to reach out to a supervisor.
Then why didn't he terminate the chase then?
As testified to and as is clear in the record and even the findings of the post board, the increased threat to the public was what was in his mind, in Officer Wenzel's mind.
But we don't look at the subjective. We looked at what an objective, reasonable officer would have done in that situation.
But you do look at the conduct of the fleeing felon to determine what was appropriate or reasonable under those
right.
circumstances.
And this felon had no intention of stopping at any point. It was pretty clear from the video that when they were reaching 130-plus miles on northbound 169, correct, he was not going to stop.
No, I agree. Police work's not pretty. What happens during policing is something that takes a special person to do.
Can I ask just to clarify?
Yes, sir.
How do you interpret the board's ultimate conclusion factually? But what I'm getting at is, was the deadly force the ramming only of the car, or was it the pursuing it? Or was it both, in your opinion?
I think the evidence in the record, the use of deadly force, was the ramming.
Okay, so it really doesn't matter for either expert on whether he should have, and maybe argue, that's part of your point, it doesn't matter whether he had authorization to pursue him, it's the point of the ramming that was the deadly force. And why is that a wrong conclusion?
Well, that's a wrong conclusion because based on the increased threat of harm, the motoring public, and the need to bring an end to that threat, Officer Wenzel made the determination that when Mr. Goodham applied the brakes, that he was going to ram that vehicle to stop the pursuit and bring the threat to an end.
Using your phrase, the bad guy is already hitting the brakes, why would you need to ram it? And why would you need to ram it four times?
Well, I don't think this is disputed in the record. It was an intentional ram the one time. The other three contacts with the vehicle were either a mistake of accelerator brake or slip-off brake, what have you. There were four contacts with that vehicle. The vehicle came to a stop. Airbags were deployed. The fleeing individual was arrested and convicted of a felony flee.
But maybe another way to say it, though, if the driver of the getaway car is braking, it has come to an end, right? And so the officer could have simply stopped and then got out and, I assume, arrested him at that point. And then I'm assuming your client would have a much better case that there was no evidence to support a revocation.
I see I'm out of time. Can I answer your question?
Yes,
Your
sir.
Honor. Thank you very much. Well, I think that cuts two ways. I think the evidence in the record and Officer Wenzel's testimony was when that opportunity arose where there was a slowing, it was an opportunity that he perceived would be to ram that vehicle and bring it to a stop. Rather than ram at 50 miles an hour, 60 miles an hour, 100 miles an hour, this was an opportunity that allowed him, in his determination based on the circumstances and what he was facing at that split second, to end the threat.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. And you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Counsel, for respondent, you have 15 minutes. Please be mindful of the clock there, and please state your name for the record and party you are representing. With that, you may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Assistant Attorney General Chris Kaiserschott, and it is my honor to represent the Minnesota Post Board. This case involves an appeal from the board's order revoking relator Thomas Wenzel's peace officer license for inappropriately using deadly force without authorization to stop a high-speed pursuit. Specifically, after inappropriately pursuing the vehicle north in the southbound lanes of a divided highway, Highway 169, just north of St. Peter, Wenzel used deadly force without authorization under Minnesota law by intentionally ramming the vehicle as it began to brake and slow down four times. First, in a failed attempt to stop. That he intended to do it, he tried to, he rammed him, it didn't work. Then he confused his brake and his accelerator and hit him four more times.
I believe it was three more times.
Or three more times. Correct, Your Honor. I misspoke. With his engine roaring, and then the vehicles came to a stop. And the driver, Mr. Gunham, was then taken into custody.
Can I ask, Counsel, I didn't see it, but maybe you can point it out. Did either the ALJ or the board make specific credibility findings regarding whether indeed it was an accidental slipping?
I think that everybody just took him at his word, Your Honor. There is no dispute that it was accidental. But that does go to the ultimate thing of ramming as to it is not an accepted police practice because of the uncertainties and the unpredictability of it. And this just goes straight to why you should not ram.
So do you interpret, and I had the same question for counsel for appellant, that the deadly force was the single ramming, not the pursuing, or not the accidental three, but the single first and only ramming, and does the evidence support that as a deadly force under this circumstance?
Let me answer that two different ways. The board looked at the totality of the circumstances as to what put him on Highway 169 at that very moment. That yes, you can't just look at it in a vacuum and suddenly roll the clip, only watch the 10 seconds and make a determination. The board had to look at the entirety of the circumstances. But yes, the actual deadly force was the four rammings that occurred, one intentional, three unintentional. So, but you have to look at the entirety of the circumstances. You can't just put blinders on and say, okay, well, here we are, we don't know the circumstances that led up to this. That would just be very poor decision-making by the agency. It has to understand okay, what would a reasonable objective officer do under these circumstances? And in this particular instance, you have it, it had the benefit of the dash cam video, it had the benefit of an internal affairs investigation, it had the benefit of the St. Peter Police Department's preliminary investigation.
As a matter of legal interpretation and a definition, is pursuing a vehicle, even if his superior would not have authorized it, constitute deadly force?
No, I think that we go to 609.066, and this is the main difference between the board's position and the respondent's position. The board adopted under 1600, 6700, 609.066. It did not adopt a Fourth Amendment reasonableness, you know, whatever happens under the Fourth Amendment analysis, including the relative culpability of the parties, potential qualified immunity, all that. The board adopted 609.066, which specifically defines what deadly force is. And specifically, Your Honor, I'll also note that the parties agree on appeal that deadly force was used when he rammed. It was the ramming that was the deadly force. And then the bottom line for the first issue is whether substantial evidence supports the board's decision that the deadly force was without authorization. And then the second issue on appeal, of course, is whether the board abused its discretion when it revoked the license.
So just to clarify, though, that if he had called his superior, the chief, he wouldn't have asked him about, he wouldn't need to ask him about pursuing it because that's not the deadly force. He said, would you give me authorization to ram him once I get close enough or he stops?
Well, technically, Your Honor, under the policy, he cannot pursue the wrong way on 169 without supervisor authorization. So as a matter of the policy, he would need supervisor authorization. But the policy also specifically said you need supervisor authorization to ram because ramming is considered deadly force under the policy.
Can I ask a follow-up question on that? Because the policy seems to be somewhat unworkable. How in the world are you going to How is a police officer going to say, hey, I'm engaging in this high-speed chase here. We're going northbound on 169, and I'm concerned that if he turns off onto southbound in the opposite direction, can I chase him down there? And if I have the opportunity, can I ram him? It seems like a hypothetical that is just unknown at that time. And very unworkable in terms of how do you get your superior on the phone when you're engaged in a high-speed chase and you're really trying to make sure that you're safe, the public's safe, and you're able to apprehend the felon.
Thank you, Your Honor. Two points on that. The first is the law specifically recognizes that a department has the ability to limit its officers' discretion in its policies. This was St. Peter Police Department's policy to say, listen, we are going to take away the discretion to pursue the wrong way on 169. We are going to take away the discretion to ram because as a department, we think that these are just highly unacceptable. The second, as far as is it somewhat impractical, Officer Winsell was calling in positions, speeds, whatnot on his radio. Just as easily as he's calling in, someone get the chief on the phone, get me some supervision here. It's not a matter of picking up the cell phone, scrolling through contacts. That's just silly. He has a radio. He's calling into dispatch. So get the chief on the phone.
I don't know why you're looking at me when you're saying right. Talking on the phone in the car. But
right. So in any event, let me just come back to the standard of review really quick because as the court pointed out, the board's decision is entitled to a presumption of correctness. Conclusions are entitled to deference. These are tenured law enforcement professionals reviewing this. This isn't a bunch of bureaucrats sitting in behind some desk, mid-level bureaucrats in an agency. These are folks who are wearing the badges, who are making this determination. So there is deference given to their conclusions in this specific area. And significantly, the substantial review does not afford the court with the opportunity to reweigh the evidence, to reassign credibility, as Relator's brief repeatedly asked the court to do. Rather, the court is just looking to review whether the board adequately explained its conclusions and whether they have a reasonable basis in the factual record. And of course they do here, and it should be affirmed.
Counsel, just point of clarity. It seems like we're muddling over the chase itself and then the decision to ram. It seems to me that regardless of how he got there, at the point that he had the opportunity to take that car out, it was incumbent upon him to do so that it didn't in any way continue the wrong way down the highway. So it seems that that moment of use of force is different maybe than the errors that were made in creating the environment by continuing the pursuit.
I think, Your Honor, thank you for the question. I think what the board looked at was that the entirety of Officer Winsell's reactions were disproportionate to the threat. And that played into, I think, the discipline, and that ultimately plays into his use of deadly force. And specifically, the one thing that my opponent keeps dancing around is 609.066 is the controlling factor here. That's the law that's in play, not the Fourth Amendment, but 609.066. That says you can only use deadly force when necessary, and then under three specific clauses. One, that there has to be an apparent risk of injury, and then the others has to do with fleeing felons or someone just shot up a school and you think he's going to continue to shoot people up. These are unambiguous directives. This isn't the gushy what is reasonable under the circumstances and you got to take the relative culpability. That's nowhere in the statute. We're applying the statute here, and that's the entire fundamental failing of their reliance on all this federal case law disposing of civil rights claims is those cases don't interpret 609.066. Maybe they're concentric circles with the, I think it's Graham v. Connor has similar language, but then Scott v. Harris later says, well, wait a minute, there's no deadly force standard as a matter of Fourth Amendment law. You have to do what's reasonable under the circumstances. Those words don't appear anywhere in 609.066.
Counsel, I'd like to hear the answer to Judge Kirk's question. I don't know if you answered it. The issue, as I understood it, it still boiled down to the fact that would equal the deadly force, which is the ramming. And so what was your answer to Judge Kirk's question? That wouldn't it behoove the officer at that point, regardless of what mistakes and misjudgment may have occurred up to that point, that would make it wrong to ram the vehicle to be sure it doesn't continue in the wrong way?
Absolutely not. Reckless driving does not authorize the use of deadly force. This was reckless driving is what it was. The driver attempted to avoid
fleeing a peace officer in a motor vehicle.
Yes.
That's a felony.
It is a felony,
a robbery that he's fled from, so at least there's some reasonable suspicion that this guy was involved in the robbery that was called in the first place. But the point being, he's going the wrong way on 169, and isn't it important to disable that vehicle from continuing to go?
Your Honor, one significant factual, there was no robbery. He was, Officer Winsell and his other St. Peter Police Department officers responded to a potential in-progress burglary. When they arrived at the scene, Winsell, because the police station is 250 yards away, I mean, he got there in under 30 seconds. He knew, Officer Winsell conceded, he knew that they had not committed any crime in the park. He knew that they did not have any weapons. He knew that there was no damage to the camper, that there was no burglary that had taken place, nothing of the sort. He, perhaps because it was the quickness, we don't know what would have played out if it would have been 2 minutes or 5 minutes, but there was no crime that occurred at that park. And so at that point, you have fleeing. Okay, yes, absolutely. Fleeing is a felony, but it is not triggering Clause 2 of 609.066 sub 2, where it says it has to be a felony involving great bodily harm or the use of deadly force. The legislature has declared that simply because somebody's fleeing doesn't mean that you can use deadly force. The Mum case confirmed this previously where, okay, you had somebody who was driving recklessly the wrong way, and no, you can't use deadly force. Tennessee v. Garner, even though that's not the applicable standard, the U.S. Supreme Court said in Tennessee v. Garner, no, listen, if a suspected burglar flees, it doesn't mean you get to start firing bullets over his head. That's not the law. The use of force is the greatest entrusted responsibility for peace officers. That's a specific finding by the board. And that greatest entrusted responsibility, you only discharge deadly force when you are authorized to do so. In Minnesota, the directive is very clear. 609-066, sub 2, clauses 1 through 3. Which of the three clauses is Wincell claiming that he falls under? What counsel just articulated and what Wincell articulated on cross-examination was it's this generalized threat of public safety. Generalized threats of public safety don't authorize the use of deadly force. That's what the board ultimately came down to, is you have to have something more than a general threat. There has to be imminent harm, imminent death. And Officer Wincell, he decided to go cowboy on this one. He had a bunch of other officers responding to the area.
Let me ask counsel, based on the explanation you just gave, that it was simply reckless, and at that point, it strikes me as, and the LJ judge used the phrase draconian, and I realize the board didn't have to follow that, but I didn't see anything in the record of any prior similar conduct, anything conduct that would approach anywhere near this. So we'll assume it's the single incident. And I think part of the explanation that was made by the board was that we don't need to wait till there's a death. But you're telling me that at most this was reckless. He should have not, he didn't have to, any threat had ended. And so given that, what you're saying about the action then, presuming that there needs to be discipline, why does the leap to revocation not arbitrary and capricious in this case?
Okay. First, here we go to the standard of review. The standard of review as to discipline is abuse of discretion, arbitrary and capricious. If there are two available options, it cannot be arbitrary and capricious. It cannot be an abuse of discretion. We're talking about the greatest entrusted responsibility is to only use deadly force when authorized by law. Here, the board concluded that someone had used deadly force when unauthorized by law. Under those circumstances, revocation has to be on the table. If you have officers using deadly force without authorization, you at least have to consider revocation. Here, the board looked at the public interest of what would happen if he wasn't held accountable. May I finish answering the question?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. That Wincell did not use deadly force without authorization, once again, under its license, particularly when Officer Wincell had already said under testimony that he didn't believe he violated the law. In addition, there's a deterrent effect on other officers. There is the accountability to the public of not holding officers accountable when something like this happens. So the board considered all this. The board explained it fully why it rejected the ALJ's unsolicited opinion that revocation is a draconian sanction. So ultimately, the relator in this case has not carried his burden of proof to establish that there's any reversible error, and the board requests the court to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just to clarify, counsel had indicated that use of deadly force is only allowed or reasonable or justified when there's an imminent harm or threat or death. The statute under which Officer Wincell was operating in September of 2021 was Minnesota Statute 609.066, Subdivision 2, which states, notwithstanding the provisions of 609.06 and 065, the use of deadly force by a peace officer in the line of duty is justified only when necessary to protect the peace officer or another from apparent death or great bodily harm. That is the standard. That is the standard the board was to apply. And while the statute in Minnesota has words, we all know, and that's why we have appellate courts. The job of appellate courts, and I don't want to tell you what your job is, but as I see it, is to breathe life into those words. To let the public know, what does that statute mean? To let an officer know, when are you justified to use deadly force? It's an apparent threat of great bodily harm or death. What does that mean?
But isn't our job as an error-correcting court to review the board's decision, which is made up of peace officers, as to whether or not their decision is supported by by facts and the record.
By the record in its entirety. That is your, this panel's job in this particular case. But I think it's important to note that originally Investigator Kaufman and Chief Grokow had made the determination that the initiation of that pursuit was not even appropriate. At the testimony during the contested case hearing, they changed that testimony. They said, yeah, the initiation of that pursuit was appropriate. Even Mr. Elpert changed his opinion.
But does that really matter when really that informs the ultimate action that was taken at the end in terms of ramming, but wasn't the ramming the deadly force?
The ramming is the use of deadly force, you're correct. But it goes to the support in the record in terms of what the opinions, what the testimony was, what the facts show. The court is not only tasked with looking at any uncontradicted evidence offered by the state, but the contradictory evidence offered by Officer Wenzel, either through direct evidence or through cross-examination.
That's not our job to weigh that evidence. That the contradicted evidence is what the board looks at and makes a determination based on, in part, on credibility.
Right, and just so I'm clear, I'm not asking you to weigh that evidence, but it is the appellate court's job under the standard of review to look at substantial evidence in the entire record. That was my point, Your Honor. And again, the policies in this case are deficient, and I think they're a red herring. As the court will note, one policy said, well, if you're going to pursue somebody or be in wrong way, chase on 169, it's okay as long as you're in front of the fleeing vehicle with your lights and sirens on to warn oncoming traffic. Mr. Elpert, even the chief of the St. Peter Police Department, found that that was nonsensical. That did not make any sense.
Right, but is that even applicable here? Because the policy that seems to apply is the ramming, the policy prohibiting ramming.
It is applicable to the extent that the conclusion of law made by the board that the contours of Minnesota Statute 609.066 are further defined by training and policies, I think it's part of the package.
But that didn't apply here. I mean, we're just looking at the policy that was applicable to the particular facts here in
this
case. But
the problem is the board looked at those policies. They looked at the pursuit policies. Should they have considered that in making their ultimate determination? Probably not. The only issue that should have been addressed was the use of force of ramming.
Why can't you look at the policies? I'm not quite sure I follow that argument.
Well, the policies under the Wren decision and other decisions, the policies cannot usurp the discretion or the review of the reasonableness of an officer's actions.
Well, but you seem to be relying on a lot of federal case law and the Fourth Amendment argument, but really, isn't it like the Munn case seems to be the most applicable case? That's the 2006 case from the Minnesota Supreme Court, which is very similar, and then looking at the statute 699.066?
Yeah, Munn is clearly distinguishable because that involved an incident where officers were called to assist with an individual suffering from mental health issues and to assist. That individual had not committed a crime, had not been alleged to have committed a crime. Mr. Gutman, in this case, the officers were called to the... May I finish answering the question? Thank you. Officer Wenzel, St. Peter Police Department, the county sheriffs were called to the campground in St. Peter to respond to a burglary in progress. A burglary is a crime of violence. That's a very clear distinguishing factor between Munn and this case. And also, the threat had increased based on Mr. Gutman's actions. The threat had not increased based on the individual who was suffering from mental health issues in the Munn case. We would respectfully request a reversal based on the information in our brief and the arguments made today, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Counsel. Thank you both for your arguments and your extensive briefing on this issue. This is a very important issue. We will be issuing a decision within the 90-day statutory timeframe. Thank you both.